2019 goals include launching a new product or service, or even a new business? Whether you're an intrapreneur or an entrepreneur, chances are that if you're listening today, you are a change agent and innovator with many new ideas, some of which you're hoping to explore further or even launch in 2019, especially in the clean tech world, which today evolves daily. But how do you protect it? When should you open source it? How do you know when to protect it or what part to protect? What should you have to pay to protect it? When can you license it? Today, we're going to find out from one of the top intellectual property attorneys in the country with 25 years of experience addressing exactly these issues. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkable, innovative women in science, technology, engineering, and math, particularly in and about energy and sustainability. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, on greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain insight from more women like me and our accomplished guests, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter where you work. When we are developing a new idea, product, or service, or writing a book, it's both exciting and incredibly daunting. We feel very vulnerable. We don't know who to talk to about it. You become so invested in your idea and passionate about it. Well, it's scary to even address or think of these legal issues. But you must, because if you're not properly protected, all your hard work may go out the window into someone else's wallet. To help us address these issues, I'm delighted to introduce you to Christina Martini, a veteran intellectual property attorney with 25 years of experience in two of the top 100 global law firms and currently a partner with McDermott, Will, and Emery. Tina focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, advertising, unfair competition, and entertainment law. She has received many awards and accolades for her work. And one interesting thing about Tina is that she studied engineering, which I'm sure adds to her understanding of these issues on a deeper level. She's also host of her own podcast, Paradigm Shift, and has done episodes on our favorite topic, innovation, and is co-host of a legal affairs show in Chicago, where she joins us from today. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Tina, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Joan. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. So let's start off with this. So we're all working from the same starting point. What is your definition of intellectual property?
Intellectual property, it's interesting because I started my career actually as a real estate lawyer. So it's, so we call that, dirt law or real property versus intellectual property. And in my mind, intellectual property is really the discussion of ideas, thoughts, inventions, brands, authored works, anything that is really not real, not really tangible, but is really a byproduct of someone's creation. And we really talk about those three lanes primarily, trademark being branding, copyright being authored works, original works of authorship is the technical definition, and then patents are really about inventions.
Ah, okay, great. That helps a lot. I was going to ask you about the difference between them, so thank you for doing that.
Sure.
When is the right time to contact an attorney about protecting our idea or our intellectual property? Is it like when you have the idea or when you draft the business plan or when you're buying a domain name or what's the right time in the process?
That's a great question, and I think that it really depends on the circumstances. If you are just brainstorming something and you really don't have a real crystallized idea of what it's even going to be, it's probably not the right time to consult a lawyer. If you've got something that you've been tooling around with, either an original work of authorship, for example, a book that you're thinking about going public with and trying to find a publishing house for, or if you are looking to, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, start offering a product or service and you're thinking about the branding around it and you are at the point where you've actually developed what you think is a brand that you may go forward with, or a tagline or a logo, that's probably the time you should start consulting with a lawyer, or at least start mapping it out. When it comes to like something like a patented invention, something in that bucket, if it's something that you are actually starting to get drawings together and you're really starting to crystallize your idea about what it's going to look like, or potentially thinking about a process or a way of a method of manufacturing something or doing something, particularly something online, you really do need to start thinking about consulting with a lawyer. And there are really two reasons for it. First of all, to make sure that you do what you need to protect that idea, protect that brand, protect that invention, but also to make sure that you're not infringing somebody else's rights, and to make sure that you have enough for purposes of moving forward with, and to get some guidance as to where there may be some holes that you need to fill first before you try to protect it and go public with it.
That's really good. And also, I imagine, I mean, the I filed a patent a while ago, which I think I told you when we met, and sometimes patent attorneys or IP attorneys also tell you what to put in the application to help it get through, right? Get approved.
Yes. And, you know, especially in the patent space, that's definitely something that lawyers can do. And I think sometimes people don't realize that sometimes you don't need to have the lawyer doing absolutely everything. And we see that particularly in the patent space, where we encourage our clients to try, especially when it comes to getting the paperwork together to explain the invention, to the extent they know what the landscape looks like for potentially competing products. The more they do on their own, the less expensive it's going to be for the lawyer. But I would definitely recommend working in tandem with a lawyer at least a little bit, as you said, to make sure that you button up your application before you file it.
One of the things that I found is that they also help you figure out the right, literally the language, because let's face it, you want this to be approved by people who sit in the USPTO, right? The Patent and Trademark Office. And they probably look for certain language, don't they?
They absolutely do. And I would say that that's true, whether it's copyright or trademark or patent. In my experience, the copyright applications can sometimes be among the easiest of the three different disciplines, with the trademark applications being the second easiest, and then the patents being the most complex. And it's for that very reason that they are looking for the claims, for example, that really define the scope of the patent protection that you're looking to get. The claims language, to those who are not lawyers, I think can sometimes seem like a foreign language. And it's really like, because you're straddling not just very technical language, depending on the nature of the invention. Some of the inventions understandably get pretty technical from like an engineering standpoint. But then there's also the legal language, and understanding also that your audience with the PTO is attorneys. Trademark, on the trademark side, you're dealing with lawyers who have decided that they want their practice to be working with the United States Patent and Trademark Office and examining applications. And the same is true on the patent side.
Very good point. So a lot of my guests and listeners work for someone else, but they have a side hustle. Now, when you work for someone else, it's considered work for hire. But if you have a side hustle and you invent something on your own time, how does the ownership work then? And what can you do to protect whatever you do in your side hustle? So, for example, if you're writing a book on the side, or if you're inventing, you know, something or another, I mean, how do you protect it from being considered part of the work for hire?
You know, that's a great question. High level, I would say that a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, if they're working at a company or for an agency or even for a relatively small business, they may have an employment agreement. And I would definitely recommend that for those folks who are, you know, creatively developing their own thing, you know, the side hustle, as you call it, it's really important to make sure that you've got your T's crossed and your I's dotted from the very beginning. And what that would look like is taking a look at your employment agreement and seeing how your employer defines whatever you create, where it sort of falls into the spectrum. So some employment agreements are easier to interpret and to know where you stand than with others. But one of the things you have to really guard against is the possibility that sometimes these things are a slippery slope and the lines get blurry. And we see this not only with respect to writing books or other creating other types of works that are typically covered by copyright, but also from a patent perspective, because there are a number of instances where you've got folks, for example, that are employed by a university who may be doing research at the university, but then have their side hustle. And they have to be really careful to make sure they look at their employment agreement, see where those lines of demarcation are drawn, and if necessary, consult with a lawyer, because what you don't want is to create your own side business and even start filing patent applications where you've got an employer for a university, for example, or an agency who takes the position that whatever you're creating in your side hustle really falls within the scope of your employment and really belongs to the company or to the university or to the organization and is not yours. And then you may end up getting yourself into a pretty difficult legal predicament if they take you to court and if they take the position that it's theirs and not yours.
Yeah, I have a very good friend who years ago, she remained nameless at the moment, but she developed a screenplay and a software program that became quite successful. And she had been working for the government part-time at the time, and some people in the government tried to claim that it was government property. Of course, once it was successful, not during the time that it was launching. You know, they always wait till you're successful to do that. I think she ultimately triumphed because she's a tough cookie and has a lot of resources. But those kinds of things can indeed be tricky. And I had this, a woman is in one of my mastermind groups and she works for a big company and she even had to run our NDA by them, even though this is a separate relationship from her job.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And I think it depends on the industry and it depends on the nature of what your job is within that organization in that industry. Because I think that a lot of times folks, especially if they've got a long tenure at a particular organization, may have signed their employment agreement very early in their career. They were very thankful for the job and they may have given away more than they would have necessarily been inclined to at this juncture in their career.
Very, very good point, which goes also to, you know, you might want to evolve if you're at a company for a long time or any institution, any employer, you may want to evolve your employment agreement as you evolve in your career, right?
Absolutely. And what you see is often companies reboot their employment agreement. They revise it as their business evolves. And, you know, there are certain times where there are certain provisions within an employment agreement that are very difficult, if not impossible, to negotiate. And it really depends on, again, who your employer is and what the stance they take is with respect to that particular position and who you are and all of that. So there's some things that you may not be able to negotiate, but there may be certain things that you are able to negotiate. And if you ultimately decide that you're going to part ways, your termination or your withdrawal agreement, whatever they call it, that's another inflection point that you should be very mindful and careful about what you agree to, because there are certain things that will sometimes find their way into those types of agreements that could impact your going forward.
Really, really good point. And I would guess that if you're going to try to renegotiate it as you evolve your job with them, once you've been there for several years, you have more clout, more capital, if you will, to make some changes to that agreement rather than doing it from, you know, when you're just being hired and you don't have really much clout at the beginning anyway.
That is the hope, at least, right? I think that sometimes the tables may reverse depending on the organization, what kind of changes they've gone through, whether they're going through a reorg, for example, and where your job or your position falls within the bigger framework of the organization. But that's, you hope that the longer you're there, the more bargaining power you have.
That's a very good point. That's a very, especially in the age of downsizing, right? Just ask the people at Tesla and General Motors who are about to lose their jobs. So speaking of these kinds of agreements, when should you have someone sign an NDA? A lot of investors won't sign them at all, and they won't even talk to anybody who demands them. But when should you sign an NDA, and what are some tips for a good one?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I would say that there's general language that is pretty standard and universal in an NDA. And it's the type of thing where, like, when does something fall outside of the NDA? And for example, one of those things is when it's when it becomes public domain or otherwise known to the parties. I mean, I think that if you're somebody who is trying to shop around an idea, I think becoming very well versed on what is protectable versus what is not protectable in terms of ideas or thoughts or any other information that you may be able to convey. I would recommend a couple of things in terms of the approach to the NDA. First of all, I think you need to educate yourself about who you're speaking with in terms of investors. Or other folks with whom you may need to have an NDA in place, like a manufacturer or potential business partner or what have you. And I think you need to know who you're dealing with and what the likelihood is that they're going to accept an NDA or not, and how enforceable it will be against those individuals. Do they have deep pockets? Do they not have deep pockets? If something goes off the rails, what is the likelihood that you are going to get the remedy that you are seeking under an NDA? And if you find that the folks that you're going to talk to, some of whom don't want an NDA or will not accept an NDA, I think it's really important to consider consulting with a lawyer about what that presentation or what those discussions look like when you don't have an NDA in place. Because there are ideas and thoughts that you can convey that would not be protectable in and of themselves. But when you start getting into secret sauce, so to speak, whatever it may be, whether it's about a brand or whether it's about an invention or whether it's about an artistic work, that's where you have to be really careful about sharing more than you otherwise would, knowing that you don't have a protection in place.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. So here's an example. I don't know if I mentioned this when we met, but my great-great-aunt was a reporter who personally kept the suffrage movement in the headlines in the late 1890s through ratification in 1920. And she also was a fiction writer. And a historian found me and wrote a book about my great-great-aunt, which is coming out this spring. And one of the things that we ran into with the publisher is that we had to point out that most of my aunt's work is in the public domain now because it was so long ago. And so they couldn't, and in fact, some of her work was considered source material even for Wonder Woman. But we, you know, they had to make sure that everything was in the public domain before they would approve her book.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's another dimension, particularly when you're talking about copyright, for example. Copyright's a very interesting set of laws, and the whole idea of what's public domain versus not, sometimes folks conflate what public domain is versus stuff that is publicly available. It sounds to me like the publisher wanted to just make sure that they weren't potentially infringing on anybody else's rights, especially in this situation. It sounds like we're talking about people and places and events and accounts that go back many years. And I'm sure that they were concerned about there potentially being a number of different people who could claim copyright to different aspects of the story. And when you're talking about a story, it's really about the way that it's told. So for example, this book is probably going to be protectable under copyright, not so much because individual passages are protectable, but it's really the compilation and the end work product, the way in which everything is knit together, that in and of itself could be protectable by copyright. But it sounds like they wanted to mitigate the potential issues of having folks being able to claim that there was a copyright infringement of some sort here.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, because it is kind of uniquely tied together. One of the other issues with innovation, and you talked about this in some of your own podcasts, is collaboration is so important. So how do you know how to structure sharing ownership or whether to share ownership in a collaborative situation? If you're just brainstorming with a bunch of people, you know, and somebody comes up in the course of it with a great name that you decide to use, you know, how does that work? I mean, where are the boundaries and how does that, what do you suggest?
Fantastic question. And I think there's a lot of dimensions to the answer, and we can take it in whatever direction you want, but I'll throw a couple of things out there. First of all, you know, to the extent that you are collaborating with coworkers about a work product that is going to be owned by the company, that's pretty easy, right? Because everybody who collaborates and contributes to that, it's going to ultimately be owned by the company. And just for those of you out there who have like a side gig that you have it underway or are thinking about, just know that you need to be really careful about who you collaborate with, because to the extent you've got great working relationships with people at work that who you would want to bounce some ideas off of, you need to be careful about doing that kind of thing without some kind of an agreement in place, because that fact may actually be used against you if your company comes back and ever says, hey, we take the position that this was owned by the company. And by the way, you collaborate with several people from work, which tends to, you know, prove our point. So just be mindful, because I've seen instances of that happening, and I just want to get that flag out there. To the extent you're talking about working with people who you just know through your life experiences and who you trust and believe would be good to collaborate with, I think it's really important before you even start initial discussions, you know, keep in mind who you're working with, what they're likely to want, what are you, and be very careful about defining the meets and bounds of what that conversation is going to look like. And go in knowing whether, if you're going to get into the nitty-gritty with them, understand that, you know, if you're talking about having joint ownership, whether it's a brand or whether it's a copyrightable work, you need to understand very, very carefully and deeply what the consequences are of jointly owning something with somebody or a group of people. If, you know, with respect to patents, you would be joint inventors potentially. Just understand, you know, people do it and they do it pretty frequently, but there are consequences to setting up that kind of an ownership. Another solution is if you walk in and you decide that you want to be the sole owner, working with people who would be willing to assign whatever rights they may have or be able to claim in whatever it is you're collaborating on, if they're willing to assign it over to you, you know, then that's another way around it where you don't end up with a joint ownership situation. Another alternative is to think about whether, you know, if this is a business venture that you're really thinking seriously about getting off the ground, think about setting up some type of an LLC or another type of company where that company will end up owning the intellectual property, and just making sure that whoever you collaborate with understands that ultimately it's going to be that corporate entity that's going to own the IP, and to confirm that they're willing to assign whatever rights they have in you know, in that invention or in those collaborations over to the corporate entity.
So are you saying to set up a separate LLC just for the IP?
Well, I think it really depends on the circumstances. I mean, I think it depends on what you're trying to do. I think you need to seek attorney assistance in figuring that out. But yes, there are folks that decide pretty early on that they do not want to have personal individual ownership of IP, whether it's, you know, like, for example, a band. They decide that whatever copyrights they've got in the music, in the lyrics, that they do not want to have a partnership of the band members, because there are a whole host of issues that can go off the rails with that. And we see it when bands break up, right? That the lines get pretty blurry. You know, who takes the rights to these songs? Who is able to go on tour and play the songs? And I think that if folks, entering these situations, try to plan ahead and consult with a lawyer about the best way to structure ownership, you're able to avoid a lot of these headaches.
Yeah, I think even the Beatles ran into that one, actually. So on that line, when should you file an infringement action?
That's a great question. You definitely don't want to be running to the courthouse without doing sufficient due diligence or investigation. So first you need to, you know, take a look and assess who or what is infringing you or potentially infringing you. You need to be really clear on what your rights are and what they aren't. And I'm not trying to plug the lawyers all the time, but these are oftentimes very nuanced and very fact-specific analyses that you need to do in figuring out whether to go after somebody. So first of all, assess the situation with the infringer or potential infringer. Be very careful when you do that sort of thing. I mean, when I'm doing it on behalf of clients, I'm never contacting people directly, nor is anybody at my firm doing that. We have investigative firms that do that because there are certain lines that you just don't want to cross. So be mindful of that. Be mindful of knowing what your rights are. Talk to a lawyer about defining whether or not it makes sense to go after folks. Understand that you don't have to file a lawsuit immediately if the decision is that you're going to take action. Oftentimes, there is some sort of contact that is initially made, either by you as the potential plaintiff or through your lawyer, where what is called a cease and desist letter or a demand letter gets sent to who you believe may be infringing your rights in an effort to try to avoid a lawsuit.
If someone is looking to hire an IP attorney, I mean, there's the Women's Intellectual Property Association, but, you know, I don't know who's a member of that necessarily. What should somebody look for in hiring an IP attorney?
I would look at, I would define pretty clearly what it is you're looking to get assistance with. And obviously that may morph and change, but I think it's really important to be clear on what you think you're able to do on your own, and that may change as you talk to a lawyer, and what you're looking for them to do, just so that you have a basic groundwork framework for the initial conversation. I think you also need to be really clear on what your budget is. And what is your budget today versus, you know, depending on the nature of your cash flow, your business, if you think you're going to have more money in 3 months, for example, that's markedly more than what you have today, just have a sense of what your cash flow is, because lawyers obviously cost money. Third, I would be pretty clear on what you're looking at in terms of likely costs. And I think having a budget conversation with the lawyer that you choose from the very beginning probably makes a lot of sense, because what you don't want to do is get too far down the road where you're having conversations with a lawyer and what you thought was a free consultation has started becoming a conversation on the clock, and that lawyer tells you that their billable hour rate is a rate that you just can't cover and you don't have any other mechanism for paying them. You want to avoid those sorts of situations. Understand that when you're looking at just trying to get basic guidance on how to file a trademark application or a copyright application, going to somebody who's a sole practitioner, going to somebody, maybe even a law school that's willing to help you do this pro bono through law students, through like a legal clinic at their law school, that may be a great way to get that initial, get that initial advice and get those initial things buttoned up. You tend to need a more sophisticated practice and a lawyer that can really navigate through some pretty difficult issues when you start talking about things like business arrangements, licensing, infringements, that sort of thing. That's where you really, I'm not encouraging that you short shrift any part of the process, but, you know, preparing applications and so forth, that tends to be on the simpler side of the spectrum than dealing with more sophisticated issues like the ones I just mentioned.
Really good points, all. Absolutely. Yeah, and I would say do your due diligence.
Oh, absolutely. And see if you can get referrals from people. Sometimes the best relationships you can start or find are with people that you know and trust who have had to cross this bridge before and have people that they can send you to.
You have such an interesting story. Tell me about a decision about midway through your career so far, whatever that feels like to you, that in retrospect seemed like a turning point for you. What that was, how you made the decision, and what do you think about it now?
Wow, that's a great question. So, I mean, there were a few of them. I mean, a couple of companies that were clients earlier in my career, I had the privilege of going on secondment to them, which for folks who are not familiar with that, what that means is I was essentially an attorney on loan. I still had work back at my firm, but I was essentially on site 50% of the time and both of those tours of duty ended up being about a year. Those were pretty big inflection points, albeit relatively early in my career, because I could have, I was offered job opportunities at both companies, and they're both very reputable companies. One of them is a food company and the other one is a pharmaceutical company that has since been bought by Big Pharma. And I made the decision to stick it out and continue to be in private practice rather than working for a company. And I do think that was the right decision, because I think there's so much that I continued to learn and continue to learn today that I don't think I would necessarily learn in the same way if I decided to be a lawyer at a corporation rather than a law firm. I would say more recently, making a decision, I would say this was probably, about 14 years ago now. So, you know, a good 10 plus years into my career, I decided to be very mindful and focused on obviously being the best lawyer I could be and putting clients number one, but also developing skills from a leadership perspective and contributing to my firm as well as to various associations and groups outside of my firm by taking on various leadership roles over the years. And looking back now, I think it's critically important that I had made that decision. I had some people who were very supportive of me, who were mentors at the time, who said it was a great idea. I had others who said, you know, it's a colossal waste of time and you should be focusing on billing hours and focusing on, you know, just going to market and other business development activities. And what I have found is that actually it was a very important developmental step for me, and has actually those leadership opportunities and roles that I've had have actually helped me with business development, because it's all about relationships and it's been a mechanism by which I've developed relationships with people.
Oh, I'm sure. And I mean, you become in effect probably a rainmaker, but just by virtue of building relationships. It also, I think, makes you probably a better communicator, because you're having to talk to people who you don't already have some kind of a relationship with. You know, you're starting a new relationship with whoever, or you're talking about something else that's not just their case. And so it probably broadens your communication skill set as well, I would imagine, and broadens the firm's exposure at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. And also from a problem-solving perspective, there are just certain issues that you sometimes need to deal with. Oftentimes they're very political and involve people's personalities, and there isn't a straight line, black and white answer to how to resolve some of the issues that you need to resolve when you are trying to lead a particular part of a firm or lead a particular organization. And, you know, just learning how to get things done if for that type of a thing in those types of circumstances can oftentimes be very different than trying to get a client assignment done. And I think it gives you an appreciation too for the types of business and political issues that your clients have to deal with.
That's right. That's right. That's true. You can kind of relate to their situation, right?
Absolutely.
So lastly, what would you suggest to a woman mid-career who works currently in a male-dominated industry? I mean, let's just face it, the law, unfortunately, is still a male-dominated industry, and so is technology. Who wants to excel, who wants to use her education and her experience to make a difference while also being ambitious, making money, advancing her career. What would you suggest to her?
Well, it's critically important, first and foremost, to be self-aware and to know what interests you, what gives you passion, what makes you jump out of bed in the morning. Because if I didn't really love what I do, I don't think I could have done it for as long as I've done it for 25 years. And I don't think I could do it in the way I have done it, which is, it's a pretty intense career. Whether you're in-house or whether you're working for the government or whether you're working for a law firm, you really spend most of your waking hours at work or on work. You're doing it for more hours a week than you are spending with your family, for example. So you have to be really mindful of where your passion is and understand what type of work environment you think is going to align most with your interests and with your talents. Because for some people, being a lawyer for a firm is really where they get the biggest bang for the buck across all of those different lines that you just mentioned, whether it's satisfaction or monetarily or what have you. And for other people, they really don't want to be in a law firm. They want to work for the government or they want to be at a corporation. So you need to know what kind of an environment you're most likely to thrive in. And then I think you need to just do a lot of research about the different types of opportunities you can get, knowing what it is that you want to do. And understand that, yes, we're in a very male-dominated world. And the more senior you get in the law, for example, the fewer women there are that have, quote, made it. And I think it's important to always continue to learn and grow and to do things that help you to continue to learn and grow. And understand that part of that is having a mentor and or a sponsor. And it's like a patchwork quilt. And I think, you know, some people try to look for only one or two people that are like the silver bullet to help them as they continue along in their career. And I think you need to look for people and appreciate what people bring to the table and understand that there's certain things they may be able to help you with and others not so much, and that it may shift and morph over time. But having that peer group, and whether it's a mastermind class or, you know, having a group at work or a group of friends and people at work, whatever that looks like, just understand that those sorts of groups and people can really help you in the long run.
Oh, that's great. And I would also add that I'm a fan of multiple mentors and what I call mini mentoring moments, because I have found that, first of all, everybody, even mentors, come with their own, they're coming from their own experience, right? When I say mini mentoring moments, it's like our mastermind group, or it's like, you know, going to an event and you see somebody's there who's, you know, who you really value their thought, and just, you know, go up to them and ask them one or two questions. That's a mini mentoring moment, right? It's, absolutely. You're not asking for, let me have coffee with you for 20 minutes once a week or once a month. You're saying, I got a question for you.
Right, absolutely. And these often happen when you least expect them to happen. And sometimes you don't even see them for what they are until, you know, it may be a day later, or a week later, a month later, even a year or plus later, where you're like, wow, that was sort of like an inflection point for me in terms of how I was approaching something, or in terms of what someone thought of me, or whatever the case may be. And that, I think, you know, sometimes those are the most important moments, more so than having a formal mentor taking you to a formal mentoring lunch, for example.
Oh, that's great. So thank you so much, Tina, for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. You have been extraordinary, and I can tell that you're amazing at what you do and why you've gotten so many awards, and you're so accessible, and it's great. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity, and I look forward to doing it again soon.
Oh, thank you. So what cool new idea do you have that you want to protect? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson, or post it on our Facebook page, and like the page while you're there, and ask to join our new private Facebook group, or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. Find us online on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts, Spotify, anywhere. And if you want to gain insight, as Tina suggests, from more women like me and her, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, tips, and save you money and time as you grow your career or business, no matter where you work. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Check out some podcasts from one of our new sponsors, about a dozen great shows focused on lifestyle industries on Mouth Media Network, with top brand executives, industry leaders, and innovators in fashion, beauty, travel, real estate, content creation, and even spirituality industries and more. Check out Mouth Media Network, powered by Sennheiser, on iTunes, Google Play, and at mouthmedianetwork.com.